Good morning. The government calls the United States v. Mowakil. The government, it will go first because this is an Article 62, a certified case. Excuse me.
May I please the court? I am Captain Carrie Ward with Captain Janae LaPierre, represent the United States in this matter. I have heard that appellate advocacy is like walking into a conversation that is years in the making.
Would you speak up, please?
Yes, sir. You have to read and learn the voices before we can chime in. On this issue, I've read every opinion this court has issued on the Jinx Act, all predating RCM 914, and was unable to find any that referenced RCM 914. This case, U.S. v. Mowakil, is a perfect example of the mistakes made by trial counsel, defense counsel, and the military judge. It's a perfect fact pattern to establish the relationship between discovery rules, the rule for 914, and remedy. The misreading of the plain language of 914 that was applied at the trial level and its misapplication of the tenuous test set forth in U.S. v. March and the blatant departure of the military judge from the president's intent with a clearly defined and linear structure to our practice of law. This undermines the fair administration of justice, and in this matter, justice is simply not served. I'm asking this court to take the opportunity to clarify the scope and limitations of the rules for court-martial 914, as well as proper applications under our rules. In this specific case, the military judge failed to consider the nature of the loss, how the loss was caused, whether there was any material prejudice to the accused, and failed to link any of those facts or findings to her determination to exercise the extraordinary sanction of striking witness testimony.
All right, you indicated that you were going to rely on the plain language of 914 to point out all the errors. So please do.
Yes, Your Honor. The military judge specifically stated that the Jinx Act is subsumed into RCM 914. This is not the case. The entire subsection A in the original statute was specifically excluded from our rule for court for practice. Specifically, it says, anything that shall be the subject of subpoena, discovery, or inspection may not be required until said witness had testified on direct examination. In our rules, that's different. Under 701, we favor disclosures to the accused. We are required and professional responsibility to give over everything prior to arraignment. And we should. I mean, just by the nature of military justice practice, we should absolutely be fair-minded and play on even playing ground. With that rule in place, it's important to understand that if there's failings in discovery, there are mechanisms for remedy that should be exercised and are required to be exercised pre-trial. 701 considers this.
The government is arguing a 701 case. The CCA, the military judge, treated this as a 914 case.
Yes, Your Honor. At trial, the trial counsel...
In the event this court were not going to adopt the government's view that they'd now like to turn this into a 701 case, and instead you're arguing 914, how did the military judge act consistently or inconsistently with Rule 914 in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. The military judge, by stating that the Jinx Act is subsumed into 914, and engaged in a 914 analysis. However, she said that the 914 motion is triggered by the motion itself. The Supreme Court case law on this issue is United States v. Goldberg. When on remand, the Supreme Court asked, was the documents even in existence at the time of the motion? If the documents are not in existence at the time of the motion, then it's not a proper Jinx consideration. Then she went on to say that because that was the trigger, that the government necessarily failed to obey in order to compel. Well, the plain language of 914 says elects. If the government elects to not comply with an order to compel, then the defendant may seek remedy. And that's for pretty clear reasons. Under 914, in actually the spirit of the Jinx Act, the government has the option to not turn over information for many reasons, for national security, for other issues of confidentiality. But if we choose to do so, then we suffer that loss. We may suffer the witness, which is fair, because it's never going to undermine the due process rights of the accused.
All right. So the government didn't turn it over because the government lost it.
Yes, sir.
The government screwed this up.
Yes, sir.
You've got two paralegals who weren't told what to do. You've got the Chief of Justice, the unedifying spectacle of the Chief of Justice and the trial counsel pointing fingers at each other, saying it's your fault, no, it's your fault.
Yes, sir.
You alluded in your beginning to mistakes, errors made by the defense. I have serious problems coming up with any duty the defense has to pull the government out of the mud hole the government drove itself into by its own negligence.
Yes, sir, and I agree with you.
Okay, then.
But I do believe that the rules for court-martial under 701 do require professional responsibility to raise the issue, and 703 specifically requires seeking alternate remedy. They had every option to get remedy under those rules, which are required to be brought pre-trial for judicial efficiency and just really
the fair
administration.
I think that the chief judge already suggested to you not to frame your argument as a 701-703 argument, to focus on 914.
Yes, sir.
And I think what you were arguing was that the government can't elect one way or the other when something's lost. Is that what you're arguing? Does the government's case hinge on the word elect?
It does. The word
this
elect.
This is a Voting Rights Act. And what about, so that means the government could, it has no duty to preserve anything?
No, I think absolutely we have the duty to preserve.
So the government elected, would you agree that the government elected not to produce the statement here because it was not available?
I do not think it was an election they were unable to produce under the motion to compel.
Which way is that cut?
I think it cuts, honestly,
so the government can just unload everything it has.
Shred it.
And avoid having to elect because they can just say, well, we don't have any evidence. And by the way, now we're going to do the Brady Act and we're going to just unload all that stuff too.
No, Your Honor. No, but I
don't get it.
914, I mean, by its language and by the reference in the analysis, does say that this is a rule that will rarely be used as long as counsel are, and I understand that, as long as counsel are abiding by the rules of discovery. Now, if the counsel had acted in bad faith, in this case, if the counsel had just decided not to tell the accused that they lost the tape, that would be a proper 914 motion. If the 32 had happened and maybe there was a written sworn statement that the accused didn't know was considered and that didn't come up until mid-trial, that would be a proper 914 motion.
Where is there a requirement for bad faith?
Requirement for bad faith?
Is there, where is that found? Is there one, and if so, where is it found?
Yes, Your Honor. In Marsh, it alludes to that you're looking at an analysis.
I'm sorry, I can't understand.
In U.S. v. Marsh, the last case that this court opined before the enactment of RCM 914, it does allude to a balancing act between the good faith or the nature of the loss as committed by the government versus the material prejudice to the accused.
But a minute ago, you didn't want us to look at the Jenks Act.
No, Your Honor.
And now you want us to look at the Jenks Act to get the bad faith rule.
No, Your Honor. What I'm asking you to do is to clarify 914. I mean, it is based significantly on the Jenks Act. The mere language after subsection A is pretty clear, but...
And doesn't the analysis say that it's based on the Jenks Act other than one exception?
But it's a massive exception, Your Honor. I mean, it takes out everything that specifically talks about the requirements for discovery by the government. It is a different system where we have a different requirement and expectation for professional responsibility.
That gets back to your 701 argument that you're bringing here for the first time.
Well, we did raise it at APDA, and they declined to consider that issue.
On the motion to reconsider.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah.
In this case, if it is strictly a Jinx analysis, I ask you to look at the nature of the loss itself. It is true that the government committed negligence and did lose the tape, and the military judge found negligence but did not get to the level of gross negligence. The loss was disclosed to the defense counsel prior to referral. The summarized transcript was provided and not objected to. 1 hour of the audio tapes was provided and not objected to. The only part that was missing was the cross-examination and the investigating officer's questions for the victim.
Now, do you agree, or is this factually established, because I have no idea, but how long was the total testimony, the length of testimony for GP?
It was about 2 hours and 21 minutes.
2:21, and the summarized transcript?
Was very short. It was a couple of pages. But if you look at one of the earlier motions that the defense actually submitted to the military judge, it cited to the inadequacy of that 32 testimony, as she was simply unable to comprehend. She didn't have an understanding of the English language to comprehend the questions that were posed to her on cross-examination.
But I think, so just to be clear, though, you're not arguing that the summary was an adequate substitute. Just what I think I hear you saying now is that the Article 32 testimony wasn't important.
Yes, it wasn't. It wasn't an adequate substitute.
It was?
It was not.
Okay, fair enough. Okay. Why did the military judge abuse her discretion? I understand your reliance on the word elect. But it says, if the other party elects not to comply with an order to deliver a statement to the moving party, the military judge shall order that the testimony of the witness be disregarded.
Yes, Your Honor. Although
now, how did the military judge, understanding that you have, stipulating that you've made your elect argument, that the government didn't elect, so therefore this is inapplicable. But let's say we move past that. How did the military judge abuse her discretion by doing what the rule states?
Well, Your Honor, if we are relying on all the Jinks cases, they all do specify that there must be some showing of prejudice before getting to the extreme remedy of striking testimony. So the shall is not to be considered unnecessary in all cases. And under Killian v. United States, the Supreme Court did say that the judge is supposed to consider the totality of the case when evaluating the nature of the loss, the amount of prejudice that would be suffered by the accused.
But the record reflects that the investigating officer testified that her statements were, her testimony was inconsistent with her earlier statements, and that he could not, from his own memory, reproduce those.
Yes, Your Honor, he did say
now,
that.
Now, why is that unimportant?
Well, he actually clarified it later on in questioning. He said that she was inconsistent probably because she was unable to understand the nature of the questions, confirming what the defense had posited, that she just said.
But isn't that an area for that the defense says they should have the ability to explore?
Yes, they should, but, I mean.
So in this case, where the government fails to follow their normal practice and procedures, loses the tape, the record, the summary is not an adequate substitute. There is evidence that her testimony was inconsistent with her prior statements. There's no remedy at all, in your view, for the defense, despite the Jenks Act in 914. Even though they're going for the lesser remedy here of striking testimony.
Well, I believe that striking testimony is considered very drastic as a remedy. And in this case...
Well, what other witnesses were there to the alleged offense?
I can see that the victim is a key witness. She is a key witness to the government, therefore essential and necessary for the accused to be able to effectively cross-examine. But at the time of the 32, their own paralegal took over 20 pages of notes. The investigating officer, when he testified at the 39A session, said that she was inconsistent because of failure to understand, and that he had a good memory and would be able to impeach her if he noticed inconsistencies in her trial testimony. So there are alternate remedies that were not considered by the military judge before she got to drastic remedy.
Well, what's more drastic, striking testimony or declaring a mistrial, which are the two options that are available to a military judge when this occurs?
Effectively, it's the same. In this case, effectively, it is the same, which is why I think this is...
Because it's the testimony from the victim.
Yes, Your Honor.
Which indicates how important that testimony is.
Right, and certainly goes to prejudice.
Well, again, Your Honor, I take issue with that, because the military judge made specifically declined to engage in a prejudice analysis because she could not perceive a situation where the victim's the Article 32 testimony wasn't necessary for impeachment, except that in this case, the defense said it wasn't. So taking into consideration the totality of the case, she had an obligation as the military judge to engage in a proper analysis for prejudice before getting to remedy.
Is the military judge required to do a prejudice analysis when making a ruling? I thought that the Supreme Court case indicated that the prejudice analysis is reserved for the appellate courts when a decision under the Jenks Act is appealed. What they're called upon to determine is whether or not the statement is Jenks, the Jenks statement, and make their ruling accordingly, not whether or not it's prejudicial, which is typically an appellate determination.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, she has to engage in some kind of analysis, and all she did in this case was accept a proffer from the defense that it was probably prejudicial.
What about the statement, in this case, I find that the defense counsel does not have what he needs to adequately prepare for cross-examination of this witness? Is that not a statement of prejudice?
I think it's a statement of an opinion, Your Honor. It's not tied to any of her factual findings. I mean, again, all these questions that you're asking are questions that the military judge really should have been asking at the 39A, which shows a deficiency in our application 914, because if we jump immediately to a presumption of prejudice, that makes it a per se rule. And 914 has other avenues that we are supposed to consider. And if we're going with Jinx, the Marsh case indicates that there is a balance. We need to take a look at the totality of the case, the nature of the loss, and then vice that with the material prejudice to the accused.
What were the other options here, the other remedies in your view that should have been explored, or that would have put the appellant in as a comparable circumstance?
Well, the notes from the paralegal would have been something that should have been explored. That was never explained, the nature of the loss, and the military judge just accepted as proffered that 20 pages of notes that were taken expressly for the purposes of impeachment were not considered. Allowing greater latitude on cross-examination and no objection from the government when raising issues of inconsistency, allowing the investigating officer to testify as to inconsistency.
And did the government propose all of these at trial?
They did try, Your Honor, but...
Where in the record did they propose these, just for ease of reference?
It was in the... It was mentioned by the trial counsel in her closing at the 39A session. Very frequently, the military judge guided the conversation back into a 914 analysis. A Jinx analysis.
You are out of time. Are there more questions at this time? Okay, you'll have opportunity on rebuttal. Thank you, counsel. Counsel, for the appellee, please.
Chief Judge Baker and members of the court, my name is Captain Nick Larson, and I, along with Major Aaron Andrew Grant, represent Staff Sergeant Morocco, the appellate. I'd like to begin by addressing your question, Judge Erdman, or perhaps a comment about the fact that the 701 and 703 analysis is being asked for the first time at this court. And the reason why that's significant is because Certified Issue 1 asked this court to adopt an argument that has never been raised before. It wasn't raised at the Army Court, it wasn't raised at the trial court, and for that reason, that certified question is waived. This is an Article 62 appeal, members of the court, and so the inquiry for this court is, how did the judge abuse her discretion at the law that existed at the time? Especially considering that the government made no argument to the military judge at the time that she made her ruling that she should consider either 701 or 703 in her analysis. The argument at the trial court was focused on the sufficiency of the summarized transcript. The trial counsel said that the summarized transcript ought to satisfy the requirement for an adequate substitute. And then on appeal to the Army Court, the government challenged how the military judge weighed the relevant factors under a totality of the circumstances. And now, for the first time on appeal, the government asks this court to look at the entire record de novo and step into the shoes of the military judge and ask how that decision might be different under a 701 or 703 analysis, which would be inappropriate under an Article 62 review. And turning back to the second
What happened to the 20 pages of notes?
Your Honor, the 20 pages of notes, I think it was Sergeant Carr, the defense counsel.
Defense DC or defense NCO, defense paralegal. Somebody is supposed to have taken 20 pages of notes.
Yes, Your Honor.
What happened to them? Were they employed? Were they adequate? They're just hanging out there.
Your Honor, the record indicates that these notes taken by Sergeant Carr, the defense paralegal, were lost. And the military judge made a finding of fact that they were lost.
They were lost, so they're not in the record.
Correct.
They're not relevant.
Correct, Your Honor. Okay. I believe that she also took the defense counsel's proffer that they weren't emailed and he doesn't have access to these notes. And so that was the finding of fact on that case. Turning to the second certified issue, it addresses the how the military judge was to weigh prejudice under totality of the circumstances. And Judge Erdman, you mentioned that the prejudice analysis here that the government offers is akin to an appellate review. Indeed, the correct test that Marsh indicates the trial court is required to consider is if I, the military judge, don't strike the testimony, how will the accused be harmed in cross-examining this witness? Not an outcome determinative test, will the accused be acquitted or convicted based on this missing statement? The judge applied the correct prejudice analysis, or probably better to say harm, in this case, and did not abuse her discretion. And in analyzing how the accused would be harmed here, the military judge looked to who was testifying. Judge Ryan, you noted that there was, the record doesn't have evidence if there was anyone else at the scene of this crime. And the record actually that's presented to us is only this Article 39A session, but it's clear that Ms. GP was one of two key witnesses in this case. It's found on Joint Appendix page 201. The military judge also found that her credibility was at the very heart of the government's case. And on the other side, impeaching that credibility appears to be central to the defense's case. That analysis is coming directly from Riley. And so she says, looking again at the totality of the circumstances, it's clear here that it is very important for the defense counsel to have access to these, to this statement to impeach her. And indeed, the government says that because the military judge points to, she says, it's not my job to determine the usefulness of the statement, the government is characterizing that as abandoning any role that the judge should have in looking at prejudice and equates that to a presumption of harm. And indeed, she's looking to Supreme Court jurisprudence for that and citing Campbell. And the government offers Killian to stand for the proposition that there is a prejudice prong or some sort of type of prejudice required. And that's just inconsistent with the reading of that case. And I think what that case does show for us is requires the military judge to determine the events surrounding the loss of the statement. And it's precisely what the military judge did here. And that's the only part of the record that survives to this day. The events surrounding, she found that the notes were destroyed, the government conceded negligence. She found that it was, in fact, greater than that, somewhere nearer to gross negligence.
Counsel, in your view, because I'm just trying to see where in the spectrum this would be, in your view, if the government has complied with all of its discovery obligations, okay, and you, the defense, wait until trial to raise this issue, okay, which is you don't have the verbatim, you don't have the tape from the Article 13, and it turns out that instead of a failure of procedures or negligence, a fire has burnt down the legal services building and the tape has been destroyed. Does that change the analysis in your opinion, or is the government still strictly liable, so to speak, for the loss of the tape?
Your Honor, according to 914, there doesn't appear to be any totality of circumstances test. The law makes clear the Jenks Act is triggered. However, that question was presented in the yard. And because this is considered as an exclusionary, or I'm sorry, as a suppression issue, the Supreme Court has subjected this to the good faith exception. And so in that case, and I believe it was a very similar circumstance in Jari, the tapes were held, or the statement was held in a safe, unbeknownst to trial counsel, the entire building was demolished. And in that case, they found that that was a good faith exception. So if it truly, if the circumstances showed that it really was an event where the government was blameless, I think that would change the calculus substantially. But the point here is that the military judge found that the government conceded negligence, and the law requires only that she consider the degree of negligence, whether there's an adequate substitute, and as a judicially created exception, also how the accused would be harmed if she doesn't select the remedy as provided in the plain reading of RCM 914 and the Jenks Act. And Judge Stuckey, you noted to the government counsel, how is it that we can attach blame to the defense counsel for as if they have some sort of a duty to exhaust any remedies under RCM 701 or 703, almost as if it's a condition preceding before an RCA 914 motion could become right to trial. Of course, that's not relevant to the judge's determination, and for that reason, she didn't consider that. There was also evidence about an Article 32, a motion for a new Article 32 submitted by defense pre-trial. I think there was some proffer that there was a communication barrier, and that the usefulness of that statement may not have been as ideal as they would have wanted. The point here in Article 62 appeal, though, is what did the judge consider at the time that she made her ruling? And there's no evidence that the government presented that fact, that pretrial motion, to her for her consideration. And we're looking at the evidence that the judge considered at the time that she did it. She has no duty to look outside the record. And as Judge Ryan noted, writing for the majority in Blazer, the better course is to ask the parties to present their views to the judge. And that's precisely what RCM 905, which discusses motions generally, requires. When a motion has been raised, the burden shifts to the opposing party to present their defenses or objections to the motion at the time the motion is made. Any failure to raise those objections shall constitute waiver. So this idea that 701 or 703 ought to apply has been waived. Pending any questions?
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government, you have opportunity for rebuttal, please.
Just a couple of points were made when you asked the question, does the defense actually have any obligation or responsibility in this case? And the rules say yes. I know that under 914, we're considering this strictly under the 914 question, but it does directly relate back to 701, 703, and 905. As my friend pointed out to you, 701 and 703 do talk about the obligation of the defense counsel to raise the issue. A motion for continuance is actually a remedy whenever you're dealing with lost testimony or lost evidence. And they submitted a motion for continuance based on this specific issue, that there was an issue of lost tapes, and they needed to think about how to deal with that, and that was granted. That was done on January 24th, and trial didn't commence until May. Now, and then moving even forward.
Does 914 cite 701 or 703 or reverse, or are they independent rules?
Your Honor, I don't think any of our rules are independent, and both
are No. I mean, is action by the military judge under 914 subject to some sort of a 701, 703 condition precedent?
No, Your Honor, but.
Okay. Go ahead.
No, Your Honor, but the failings to address any of those pretrial issues by the military judge should be a factor when you look at prejudice and the nature of the loss. And then, as my friend couched it, he calls this a motion to suppress. And under 905, again, that is an obligation of the defense attorney to raise all motions to suppress pretrial absent good cause shown. Deciding to wait until jeopardy attaches is not a matter of good cause. So to say that we are not obligated to all follow all the rules, we only have one book. And it's a line by line from the president, start to finish, pre-trial investigation through post-trial matters, how we are to practice law.
So in your view, a defendant cannot raise a Jenks Act motion or a 914 motion if they have not earlier made a motion pertaining to that issue in discovery?
No, actually, Your Honor, I do think that. Going back to one of the earliest cases, again, cited by my friend Jerry, the dissent by Judge Cook in that case actually says that the Jenks Act only applies to that evidence that the defense wasn't otherwise entitled to prior to trial.
And what effect does the dissent have on our deliberations?
I would hope, Your Honor, that you would look at this and know that this is a discussion that has been happening, up and through the enactment of 914, and the fact that we haven't revisited that case law and looked at the basis for the cases that we have here, which were focused exclusively on the statute and not on our rules of practice, are making a per se rule. What was designed to be a protection for the government by Congress is now turning into a gotcha rule that they can use for gamesmanship.
Well, to be fair, it's designed to be both a protection for the government as to its documents, but also a protection to the defendant.
Well, absolutely, Your Honor, basically what's happened in this case, how the military judge has applied it, is going back to standards in the case Jenks versus the United States, which was abrogated by the statute. So it's not intended to be per se, and it's not intended to require full disclosure.
In the government's opinion, is Jenks still applicable to trials by courts martial?
No, Your Honor.
No, okay. Has 914 replaced Jenks?
Yes, Your Honor. Jenks is a statute under Title 18, which really is not applicable to us.
Well, we held back in the 80s it was applicable. What I'm saying is, have subsequent events vitiated that?
Yes, Your Honor. The decision to enact it as a rule of practice rather than another statutory requirement under Title 10 should be something that we should discuss. And then the case...
Wait a minute. Are you going off on the fact that it's a regulation promulgated by the President rather than a statute under Title 10? Or what? I didn't get the last allusion.
I guess my point on that is that, again, I mean... We have a set of rules. One rule doesn't trump the other. And when the rules prior to trial actually outline exactly how we are, all parties in the game are supposed to practice law.
No, well, yeah, but that wasn't my question. Anyway, go ahead.
So, counsel, I just want to be clear, and this isn't a trick, all right? In your view, taking 914, pretending it doesn't exist from it, in your view, what motion was it that the defendant was obligated to make specifically? I mean, what in your view, what motion should they have made?
To seek the same remedy that they got on this motion, I think it should have been a pretrial motion to suppress.
A pretrial motion to suppress?
The statements or the testimony of the victim.
Okay, and the difference would be what? That then jeopardy would not have attached?
Yes, Your Honor. It would have been closer in time. The government would have had some opportunity to evaluate for adequate substitutes. It would have been properly litigated under the right standards, not this per se rule that we're finding in 914, but under the requirements of the government to
You don't disagree, though, do you, that irrespective of what else the government might have tried to do, nothing was going to bring this particular testimony, the tape, back into existence? Right, you were still stuck with that situation.
Yes. And then under 905, if there had been a proper showing of prejudice, then we might get to the same remedy. Due process isn't violated by evaluating this under the proper rules of court-martial. I mean, there are many, many stop gaps. And I think it's important to kind of note that I'm out of time. So
yeah, please continue.
I think it's important to note that even if I'm wrong, The way the military judge addressed this, without taking into consideration all of the things I'm asking, you know, that it should have been brought up on discovery. It was brought up in a limited manner in discovery and received a continuance. What does that really get us at the end of the day? So what's happening is that you have a defense attorney that is willfully not following the due process rights of an accused, allowing jeopardy to attach, and then raising a Hail Mary motion asking to strike the testimony based on 914.
You indicated that...
Oh, I was just going to ask, do you think that part of the problem is the way that 914 is written? I mean, because it does say, after a witness other than the accused has testified on direct examination, do you see what I'm saying? I mean, the defense counsel complied with 914.
Yes, Your Honor. Assuming, and I think that's...
I mean, is the problem that 914 doesn't include subsection A of the Jenks Act? I mean, or what we call the Jenks Act?
I mean, it is my belief that because it expressly excludes subsection A, that we are supposed to reference all the prior responsibilities. What I think is going back to what I first asked this court to do, is that we need clarification. So this can't be a per se rule, and Marsh kind of indicated a test that we would engage in. The other federal cases that affect Jenks are persuasive for our court, but we have a different justice system. So being able to evaluate how 914 is truly going to be applied for the administration of justice for both parties, I mean, I think that needs to be articulated by this court. We haven't heard an answer since the promulgation of the rule. So if I can suggest it, I think the answer needs to be based on the Supreme Court case Killian, which requires an evaluation of the totality of the case, an evaluation of the nature of the law, so looking for good faith, bad faith. Bad faith is a different question. If the government doesn't win there. And then the timing of the loss as established in Goldberg by the Supreme Court case, and then Judge Cook in his dissent in Jerry, if it's not in existence at the time of the loss, perhaps it's not a Jenks question. And then what is the trigger? Is the trigger the if-then language in the rule itself says if the government elects not to comply, then we go to the question of remedy.
You indicated in your argument earlier that had this been brought in discovery, the government would have had adequate time to look into it more and respond properly. Is there anything in the record that indicates that this motion was a complete surprise to the government?
Yes, Your Honor, it was. There was nothing.
They weren't aware of the Jenks Act in 914?
It actually was a surprise. yes. So, okay. I mean, that was my question. The first thing was decided maybe a deposition or a new 32, and then that report didn't ask for any particular evidence. So I do think that was a surprise, thinking an issue had already been litigated pre-trial.
Any other further questions? All right. Thank you very much. The court thanks both counsel, and the case is now submitted, and we stand in recess until further order of the court.
Thank you.